Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Need Some Introduction. As usual, I'm your host, Victor. I hope you have checked out our most recent episodes, where we discussed the entire Ghostbusters franchise, and then in a completely different vein, going low and then going high, let's say, discussing the really interesting Anatomy of a Fall, available on Hulu, the Academy Award-nominated film. Going more low culture again, and there's nothing wrong with low culture, we'll be discussing a camp classic of a sort, the original Roadhouse film, and its remake, the very popular on streaming right now, Jake Gyllenhaal, direct to Amazon Prime, Doug Liman directed, very stylish reboot of this original film from 1989. Before we get to those discussions, just a reminder that I am now on Letterboxd. If you're on there, feel free to follow me. Check the show notes for the link to my profile, or just search for Need Some Introduction Podcast in the app itself. I have seen a few of you following me now, so feel free to reach out or comment on some of my reviews or lists. And of course, any feedback's always appreciated. Reach out to us, needsomeintroduction@gmail.com. Later in this episode, I'll be breaking down that new Roadhouse remake. But before we get there, I wanted to delve into my thoughts in watching Roadhouse, which I had never seen before. I should have seen this. This has always been kind of a cult classic or a cable classic. I was of age. I was a teenager when the original film came out. Missed it in movie theaters. It was rated R, so maybe I was definitely seeing rated R movies in movie theaters. Even then, it used to be pretty easy to go see rated R movies at that time, even if you were below the recommended age. But I was pretty selective about what I would go see. So I had seen like Friday the 13th movies. We usually saw those like in a group, for example. But this was not such a huge hit that it became something you had to see. As a matter of fact, I looked at the box office just out of curiosity. It came out the same year as Batman and Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, the Ghostbusters sequel, which we discussed recently, of course, Ghostbusters 2, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, Lethal Weapon 2, of course, which I saw in theaters multiple times that year. So a big year. 1989 had a lot of really big, huge, culturally significant films. And to a certain segment of the audience, this is in that classic mold. As a matter of fact, when I discussed Ghostbusters 2 in that Ghostbusters conversation earlier this week with Nick and Ray, they called out Roadhouse as one of these seminal films from this year. Well, all that is to say that it wasn't for me. It, once again, I looked at the box office. All the films I listed before made 100, 200. Batman made over $250 million back then. Think about that. That inflates to $700 million or something insane right now. So huge, hugely successful films in that particular year. Roadhouse made $30 million, which was totally solid at the time for this type of film, a relatively low budget action film. So definitely had it following in theaters, but not a blockbuster, not a huge hit. I think its following really grew once it hit cable and was just on all the time. And I can understand that too. I honestly have to say that I found most of this film kind of boring and unintentionally funny. But the last half hour or so, I really started vibing with the film and really enjoyed the last third of the film, I'd say. Like when it goes over the top and it has these really bizarre choices, shifting in tone, like it's really just off the rails by the end where they're mixing horror and slapstick. I really liked all of that. Like I was like, wow, this film is just hitting all my pleasure centers and that I didn't even know I had, to be honest, because I really don't like campy things in general. So it really has to be kind of accidentally campy for me to enjoy it. When someone's intentionally leaning into the camp, I definitely don't like that tone. So I really liked the last third of the film, for example, and really earlier on wasn't connecting with the material. It really felt just awkward and amateurish. So I can imagine having seen this on cable, for example, and stumbling upon it in the middle of the film and being like, oh yeah, I've heard about this. Let me check this out. Jumping in the middle and being like, wow, this film is really crazy. It's not at all what I expected it to be. And once again, that's my experience now, even watching it. Not what the film I expected to see at all based on its reputation. And then falling in love with it, you know, in that way. So in a way, stumbling upon this on cable in mid-flight, which was an experience we had back in the day, for anybody who, obviously, younger listeners won't even understand this, but you watch stuff that was on HBO, for example. Maybe TNT and TBS was starting to show things, edited versions of popular films, but primarily you would see things on HBO, if you had HBO. So once again, another subset of the population. And you would just catch it when it was on. But of course, it was on all the time. You would have, if it was the movie, like The Terminator is a perfect example of this. The Terminator is a film that was pretty modestly successful in the theaters, not iconic, but very popular for a very low budget science fiction horror movie. And then on cable, it was on loop all the time. You could barely turn HBO on and not stumble upon The Terminator. If you just had it on for 4 or 5 hours, The Terminator would be showing at some point. And it became foundational to a whole generation of movie nerds. But that all happened after the fact. And this is a similar thing, I think. Although this movie's not as good as The Terminator and doesn't have the same kind of legacy. So what you're getting here is my impressions of this thing, which I just saw recently for the very first time. So take all this with a grain of salt in that regard. You may love this film and be offended by my commentary on it. But I do think I appreciated the things that were there. I just have a question, and I think this is my biggest interest with this. The definition of what is a good movie? Because I think, you know, if you follow me on Letterboxd, you'll see that I gave this film 2 stars. But that makes it sound like it's just a bad movie. But this is a hard movie for me to rank because there are 2-star movies that I just think are boring from beginning to end or have good intentions and just fail at what they're trying to do. This is a film that I think I'm giving it 2 stars because it is failing at some of the intentions it has. So in that regard, if I just have to compare it to other films, if other films had the same kind of weaknesses this film had purely from a technical and character situation, you're going to call it a bad movie. But I want to be clear that it's entertaining in its own way, in its own badness. And that's kind of what I want to get into with my recommendations. So stay tuned for my recommendations because I think these are some things that I want to recommend to you that do this better, intentionally being the over-the-top action movie that is here, or unintentionally, like so bad it's good type film. So some of my favorites that I think kind of will give you some of the same pleasures that you get from Roadhouse, if you are a Roadhouse fan. So do stay tuned for that after my walkthrough of this Roadhouse original recipe. And before my conversation with Celia, the Roadhouse reboot, I will have quite a list, actually. When I was compiling this, I came up with quite a list of films. When I was struggling at first, I found a whole bunch of them. So do stay tuned for that. And I'll probably create a list on Letterboxd if that's more convenient for you to track down. And I'll include that link in the show notes as well. So the first thing I came away with from seeing the film was the idea that there are people out there that are offended that you would even try to remake Roadhouse. Now, I don't know if it's a good idea to remake Roadhouse, and I'll save some of that commentary for later, but the idea that this is some unimpeachable classic is pretty amazing to me because I really feel like it's almost an accidentally more entertaining film than it intends to be. Some of the things it's trying to do, it's doing pretty well. Some of the things it's trying to do, it's doing pretty badly, and that's part of its charm. And I do agree that it's going to be hard to try to duplicate that experience, that feeling, but that it's some kind of unimpeachable classic is, I think, a little overstated. Basically, I think that this film is like Patrick Swayze's mullet itself. It's so out of style, it's in style again, and the mullet is kind of making a comeback here, or maybe it just never went out of style at all. But in watching the film, I found it so strange, this world we enter, where this cooler, which I think is a kind of a cool idea, by the way, and something I wasn't familiar with, that you have the bouncers, but then you have the cooler. And he wants you to be nice. He wants you to keep things under control until they can't be kept under control anymore. I actually like that too, by the way. I like that bit of dialogue. It's really corny. This whole idea that he has a philosophy degree from NYU and now is cooling in bars. It's a pretty funny biography, to say the least. No matter where he travels in the country, all the bouncers know who he is. He's famous for his bouncing capabilities. I also love the actual Roadhouse itself where this is such a violent place to hang out with. I'm not sure why anybody would even show up, to be honest with you, even though Jeff Healey is there performing. But the next thing that really surprised me was when he shows up at the Roadhouse for the first time and the fights themselves. I was really put off. And once again, based on my expectations, the bar is so incredibly brightly lit. I have never seen a bar this brightly lit. And I have heard people make the excuse that, hey, it's 1989. This is what movies look like back then. And I'm like, this is not what movies look like back then. Look at the fight sequences in even the Cannonball Run or The Last Detail all the way back in the 70s, you can make a lo-fi barroom brawl, which is exciting to watch, and it doesn't have to be on a big budget. And as far as the way the style of the inside of a nightclub, for example, you think about the sequences in The Terminator or even 48 Hours, and those movies are way before this film. So I was shocked to see a presentation of this is what the Roadhouse looks like when the lights are turned all the way up. It's like going down the supermarket, frozen food aisle. And at first I thought this was kind of amateurish, and only in retrospect, here's where I'm going to have a very generous read of this, and I think I'm probably right. In retrospect, this thing reminded me, if anything, of like a saloon brawl in the movie from the 1950s or something. And I think that is, I'm going to give the movie credit here, I think that is intentional, because this is a Western, right? You got the surly outsider with the mysterious past. He is Shane, basically, right? He comes in, he's going to clean up the city. You have the mean local rancher, or maybe the better equivalent is the local rancher who is just the rich guy who kind of owns everything in the area, but he's got the out of control kid who, although we have that embodied in one particular character here, one and the same, Ben Gazzara is the psychopath and the businessman, or the successful local businessman as well. All that is to say that the archetypes of a old school Western are here. So I do think that this is intentional, even in its very strange lighting decisions and set design decisions, because some of these fights look amateurish, but once again, maybe this is, hey, we are going to make this look like an old school saloon brawl from the 1950s, really put our finger on a scale to let everybody know that this is an old school Western. So maybe something that I dinged the film for as I'm watching it, I maybe in retrospect give it some credit for playing that up. The next thing that really stood out here for me in watching this is how much nudity and sex is in this movie. It's funny that there is a whole social media conversation going on in this moment as to whether, do we even need to have sex in movies? Isn't it just exploitative? To which I say, and I'm happy to see this, by the way, there are multiple films that were nominated for Academy Awards this year, Poor Things being just one, which are very frank about sexuality. So I'm glad to say that you can deal with sex in a movie in a mature way. And I want to be clear, I do think that there are these nightmare stories in the past of women who had to have nudity or had their character rewritten to include nudity, and it was cheap nudity. You'd have a comedy where you walk into the bathroom and the girl just happens to have her top off or whatever. So imposing nudity just to have it in there, just to titillate the audience, I am completely in agreement with getting rid of that kind of use of nudity in movies. But that we can't have a mature film about sex amongst adults is ridiculous, or even sex scenes. And we'll talk about how sexless the new Roadhouse movie is compared to this one. This one, on the other hand, they have every opportunity. This is the kind of exploitative, over-the-top nudity, which is kind of shocking to see now, especially because there is nothing titillating or sexy about this. And I do wonder, like when you have that striptease, hilarious striptease, by the way, where the bad guy's mole, his girl, is forced to strip in front of everybody at the Roadhouse, one of the worst stripteases I've ever seen, as everyone just stands around, arms crossed, watching her. This is hilariously awkward, but maybe this speaks to some of the making of this film. I'd love to hear a commentary on it and see if there was, maybe this was something that was shoehorned in, like we need more sex, we need to titillate more. So they're kind of forcing the director to add these scenes to something that he thought in his mind maybe saw as more of a throwback 1950s Western. And maybe that is where some of the awkwardness of the tone shifts in the film comes in. But we have not only this nudity in this striptease, we also have the fact that there's this sex scene between Kelly Lynch and Patrick Swayze with their matching feathered bangs, which I love. They definitely go to the same hairstylist. She seems to be taller than him, and they just go for it right away. He smashes her up against this stone wall. Once again, it's good to have adults having sex. It's a part of life. We should acknowledge that in our films and in our art. This is not a good sex scene, in my opinion. I'm sorry. This is not sexy. Pretty hilarious. No one wears underpants, apparently, in this film, except for those really big granny panties during the striptease. That's the only panties we see kind of in this whole entire film. So yeah, a lot of this is just awkwardly shoehorned in there. I do also love some of these crazy plot machinations. One of my favorites is the fact that Kelly Lynch's doctor character finds out Dalton has a degree from NYU from looking at his medical records. I love that he brings his medical records with him, which, by the way, not a bad idea in 1989. There were no electronic medical records, especially if you know you're going to end up in the hospital. So, okay, fine there. I just don't know why he put his diploma in there as well. Pretty funny. Maybe it's just a way to pick up girls and maybe it works. There you go. And then, of course, the convenient plot point that she turned out to be Ben Gazzara's ex-girlfriend. And man, Ben Gazzara, the fact that they have this guy as this intimidating villain here who can beat up anybody, I guess it's just because he's such a big shot. He is so hilarious here as a villain. I mean, he is actually really committed to this performance. I think he's giving a good performance, but it is just hilarious that this is the casting you have for this type of role. He becomes like an unkillable murder machine at the end of the film. Can't even be machine gunned down. It's like the end of Scarface. And man, he's committed the whole way through. So hey, my hat off to you, Ben Gazzara. Also love his style of driving. He's just like, hey, he really owns the road, right? He could just take up all four lanes if he feels like it. But what is his plan anyway? Maybe it's possible that Gazzara has money like as a legitimate businessman outside of this core town. But it seems like his money is mostly coming from blackmailing these businesses for protection money, quote unquote. If that's his plan, then why is he destroying all these businesses? He's destroying all the cars on the car lot with his monster truck. He's destroying the reputation of this bar where no one would want to go. How is he going to collect his protection money if he's putting everybody out of business? And everybody who has a business in this town is trying to get the hell out of there. Now, by the way, well, a little preview of the remake. If your intention is to drive everybody out of town, okay, fine. But that doesn't seem to be the case. He just seems to want to be the bully. And maybe once again, this is like a throwback to those 1950s Westerns where a lot of those plans don't seem to really make sense either when you get to the bottom of killing the sheriff and intimidating the whole entire town, when at the same time you want to ingratiate yourself with the whole in the town itself, right? Theoretically, if this was a more realistic movie, you could have an example of a villain who does prop up everybody and did bring business into town. And now he can call all the shots and he can take advantage of his power over everybody and intimidate them and take their money and abuse them in any way, play with them any way he wants because they are depending on him for their livelihoods instead of this cartoonish version of this character. But hey, the movie I'm describing is not this movie. This movie wants to be a cartoon. So I'm just saying that it's a preposterous plan that doesn't make any sense, or at least if it does, I didn't get it. But I still do very much enjoy Ben Gazzara's ridiculous performance. And I say that intentionally, like over the top, great, fun, perfect for this type of cartoonish villain. And even though I have to honestly say I was bored for large sections of this film, but I very much enjoyed Ben Gazzara's performance. I enjoyed the unintentionally comedic sex scenes and things like that. Speaking of just unnecessary nudity, I like when the barmaid shows up to bring Dalton breakfast when he's staying out at that farmhouse and she catches his butt. Oops, she saw him in his butt. Once again, no one wears underpants in this. He just goes right into the jeans. So don't worry. Very funny that, you know, we just have to sneak in some additional nudity in here. Another one is once again, we've gone 5 minutes without nudity in this film. We got to throw some nudity in there when they're having the bouncer hooking up in the back room and Dalton walks in on them. And they don't even stop what they're doing, by the way. But once again, I just have to throw in a little nudity every 5 or 10 minutes. Aside for some of these campy moments, I, in general, was kind of bored with the film, to be honest, until we get to that crazy, crazy ending, which I have to discuss here. But just some of the other really memorable moments here. Obviously, Dalton's whole be nice philosophy. I also love his idea that pain doesn't hurt. So all of this, like philosophy 101, very, very funny, but not as funny as him doing Tai Chi in the morning while he's being watched by the villain who knows exactly where he is. They could kill him at any time. They blow up half the city to get him by the end, but he's right there. He's like 10 feet away from you. Like, it's not complicated. By the way, that kind of ties into the second film as well. Of course, the hilarious use of the monster truck. I do like when they're spying on him with the monster truck, like they're very subtle. No one sees that monster truck parked up the street. And then, of course, everything at the end, from the throat-ripping fight sequence, which is actually a really great fight sequence, capped off by his trying to tamp down his instinct to rip out throats. Which, just a little aside on that too, I love the fact they bring that up earlier on, and I honestly forgot that that was a thing in this movie. So when they first bring it up, it really sounds like, you know, hey, it's just like the legend of this guy. Once again, it's like a Western, right? The stranger rides into town. I heard he shot two men with one bullet, right? So there's like this kind of grandiose legend, maybe made up, about the gunslinger that comes into town. This gunslinger tears out throats by chance. But I remember as soon as they said that, I'm like, oh, isn't there something with a throat ripping in this movie? Isn't there something about that? But oh man, what a great moment when he finally tears this guy's throat out. A guy who threatens to rape him, by the way, rape him like he rapes other guys in prison, a completely unnecessary line and kind of shocking to hear, I guess, in tone with the rest of this film. And that triggers Dalton. He's gone, been pushed too far. Time to rip out a throat. And cleanly rip it out too, by the way. He doesn't just grab it and choke him out. He can pluck it out of his throat. It's pretty amazing and hilarious. But the best part of all of it, by the way, is his reaction to like, oh no, I've done it again. And of course, the film continues to escalate from there, especially once his mentor has been murdered. Another very dark turn in this film. And that leads to the final showdown where he shows up at Ben Gazzara's house. His fingers are tingling. He really wants to tear out a throat. He's able to control himself. Not sure why Ben Gazzara is the guy who is the only one he can constrain himself, because he's on a murder spree at this point, killing so many people. The one silliest bad guy, the one we kind of empathize the most with, does not get murdered. He actually gets pinned under a stuffed bear, which he shoots at. Did he think there was a real bear there? I'm not sure. Once again, just this goofy tone shift where you have a straight up horror movie in tone at the end of the film. And we have this goofy bear scene thrown in there as well. Just, I don't understand what tone they're going for there at the end. And of course, it culminates in that massacring of the bad guy. He gets shot 25 times before he's finally done. And then the cops show up for the first time in this entire movie. Hey, look, there are cops in this town. And they were waiting to pop in. But they sat outside and waited patiently until they heard all the gunshots. And then they came and said, hey, what's going on in here? So just very, very funny. And yeah, even though his friends died, even though he's torn out some throats, it's all the Dukes of Hazzard here at the end of the movie. High fives and back slapping. It all turned out okay. So what if your best friend had to die? And that is, I guess, the charm of this film, which gives you whiplash from moment to moment watching it. Okay, here come the recommendations. If you want some films from the 1980s that are in this tone, sometimes intentionally, sometimes unintentionally, here are some other classics from the 80s that you should check in. By the way, your mileage may vary on all of these titles, because a lot of your appreciation of this is going to be A, your tolerance for being intentionally cheeky or unintentionally campy, and that is an acquired taste. So take everything with a grain of salt, but I do think that if you do appreciate Roadhouse, some of these are going to appeal to you as well. First of all, Tango and Cash. There's going to be a lot of Kurt Russell on this list, by the way. I'm just a big Kurt Russell fan, especially in his 80s phase, but he was always ready to mock his own on-screen persona. And I think what's great about Tango and Cash, there's some good action sequences. It's an absolutely preposterous plot. But I think one of the things that really works in makes Tango and Cash stand up and should be kind of reclaimed in the way that Roadhouse has been is this discrepancy between Kurt Russell being so effortlessly charming and Stallone struggling to be comedic. He like really struggles to make these jokes work, and that awkward chemistry between them. And they are good together, by the way, but that adds this extra layer, the two celebrity personas basically colliding together. So once again, that's Tango and Cash. Okay, let's keep talking about Kurt Russell. On the one hand, Escape from New York, this John Carpenter classic, which I think is getting remade, or they've been talking about remaking it for so many years, from I think 1981, a big hit when it came out. And once again, effortlessly charming Kurt Russell doing a Clint Eastwood take, The Man with No Name. Definitely a Western, if you want to make the analogy. And you can argue that most of Carpenter's films are Western influenced, except for maybe Halloween, obviously. But that has some really gritty fight sequences. It is having fun with itself. You definitely will intentionally laugh at things there, but it has this gritty tone. It has a real dark underbelly to it. And I really want to call that one out, because as a bookend to that, you have Big Trouble in Little China, also from John Carpenter with Kurt Russell yet again. This incredible comedy and martial arts mashup. the type of mashup that we really wouldn't see until years later. This film was a huge flop when it came out, very expensive. The special effects, most of them, look pretty great in retrospect, considering this is 86. But the best thing about it is that Russell, Kurt Russell, is willing to play the butt of the joke. He's the guy who thinks he's the center of the movie when this whole entire mythology and all these side characters and the people who actually know how to fight and people know what's actually going on are the characters around him. And the movie's centered on him because he's supposed to be the hero because he's the stereotypical white protagonist. So he's supposed to be the hero. But he's actually looked, he stands like Harrison Ford, or, you know, basically doing a Harrison Ford impression here. But he is the butt of the joke all the time. He's the incompetent. It's very funny that they are, even back in 1986, doing what like the last action hero tried to do years later at a much, much higher budget. Both of those films failed, by the way. So I think they are more contemporary than they were then. People wanted their action straight up. But do check that out. That is funny. It is making fun of the genre of the movie, but not campy. I mean, I guess you can read it as camp actually nowadays, but intentionally making those jokes. And it's a lot of fun. And definitely check that out. Big Trouble in Little China from 1986. And then if you want one more, much darker, but very funny and very dark and incredibly prescient sci-fi action film that mixes all these comedic and violent tones together perfectly and really intentionally, RoboCop, which is basically a classic at this point, a true classic, I think. All right, on the unintentionally funny side of things, you can check out The Running Man, Schwarzenegger, doing a Stephen King adaptation, very, very loosely using the original Stephen King story here. There are some really cool ideas, this idea of like a game show where people compete to the death for people's entertainment, really foresaw some of the types of shenanigans you'd see in the future with reality TV shows. So in some ways it's forward-looking, but its tone is so campy and corny. Even at the time, I remember seeing it and like rolling my eyes at a lot of it, and even more so now when you watch it. So if you want to see Schwarzenegger at his peak, still working out his on-screen persona, there's a lot of charm to that as well. So do check out The Running Man from 1987. And one more from this era of the 80s, check out Bloodsport. This is the film that came out of nowhere and made Jean-Claude Van Damme into a star. This movie is loosely based on a true story. Absolutely preposterous that this would, that there's very, very little of this that I believe is actually based on that original true story. So it is a complete low budget B movie in plot, in side characters, in every aspect to it, which ends with, you know, culminates with this fighting tournament. But Jean-Claude Van Damme is maybe never more compelling than he is here this early in his career. Oh, and one more. I just thought of one more that I really highly recommend. Chuck Norris. This is not one of his favorite movies, but Chuck Norris has an absolutely crazy film from 1982 called Silent Rage. And this movie came out at the height of the slasher movie craze. And this movie is crazy. What a mashup of stylistics here. It opens with this mentally disturbed man murdering his family. It's very much a horror movie, by the way. He gets sent back to the mental hospital where he has gets an experimental treatment because he's been shot by the police. He's almost dead, but he has like superhuman strength even as he's dying. They inject him with some formula that basically turns him into Wolverine where he can regenerate to try to save his life. He busts out, as you would expect, goes on a killing spree, and only Chuck Norris giving one of his flattest, most uninterested performances back in 1982, early in his career, and his plethora of roundhouses could even try to take this guy down. But it has this movie has some great fight sequences, has some absolutely hilariously, unintentionally hilarious moments here in the people's reactions to this unstoppable killing machine. It has a really dark tone, but it is a combination of a slasher movie and a kung fu movie and a monster movie with a mad scientist and all of these things mixed together and almost arbitrarily from scene to scene. So it's pretty artless. I say that despite the fact that it's pretty charming in its own muddy ambitions. But maybe of all these films that I've recommended here, the one that's closest to the accidental cult classic, and that's Silent Rage, once again, from 1982. Okay, after 1989, maybe films, when I think about it, maybe films that were somewhat influenced by this film, trying to embrace the slapstick, intentionally, winkingly campy, with the high violence action as well, 1996's From Dusk Till Dawn, written by Quentin Tarantino and directed by Robert Rodriguez, and featuring Tarantino in one of his biggest roles on screen. This film starts as a film noir, family on the run, with a touch of serial killer mythology, and then turns into a completely different movie halfway through. If you don't know, I mean, you probably know, but if you don't know, I'm not going to spoil it here, but it really turns into a completely different movie. This film doesn't actually completely work for me, but I think it is going for something, which is pretty rare in the genre. So if you want to see someone really trying to intentionally almost split a movie in the middle and go with two completely different genres even and tones, then do check out From Dusk Till Dawn from 1996. And from 1994, True Lies, speaking of Schwarzenegger here, giving one of his best performances, I think, and very funny to counterpoint this to The Running Man. He's figured out his on-screen persona. He's working with James Cameron again. But I remember when this movie came out, I was thinking, he was coming off of the flop in 1993, huge flop of The Last Action Hero, a film that also was trying to be an action comedy that intentionally mocked the genre and kind of failed. And he was going again into a spy spoof, and who buys Schwarzenegger as this undercover spy? I remember seeing the trailer for this movie and really worrying that it was going to be a total disaster. Instead, it turned out to be the last really huge hit that Schwarzenegger ever had. And it really is, I think, a very good blend of this comedy and even a romance and action, of course, and a spoof as well of the genre. So I think it's pretty light on its feet for being so incredibly expensive and huge. But it is, the action sequences at the end of this movie are huge and great. So do check that out. Cameron having probably the most fun he's had in his career, as much fun as he can have as a filmmaker. Great action sequences always, of course, from Cameron. And like I said, maybe Schwarzenegger's best performance as an actor in his whole career. And finally, one of my favorite cult classics is a film called Lockout. And this is from 2012, I believe it is. Guy Pearce stars as basically the Kurt Russell character from Escape from New York. It's Escape from New York, but set in a jail in space, Sky Jail. This movie has been called Sky Jail, by the way, many times, or Space Jail. I mean, this movie's worth seeing because the action sequences are so ridiculous. It really knows exactly the type of film it is. It is completely over the top. It is wall-to-wall special effects, and they don't have the budget for them. It's actually low budget, so the special effects look pretty crazy. All of this is a blend of intentionally campy and unintentionally campy. So really what I'm looking for in these type of films. But what makes this film work is that Guy Pearce in the Kurt Russell role basically is great. Guy Pearce is an actor that I've really appreciated through Memento, through his whole career, even in more contemporary roles, not only those iconic roles early in his career, like LA Confidential, for example. He continues to be a really, really interesting actor, but he rarely will just be like, I'm going to just lean into my charisma 110%, and that's going to be the whole performance. And he gets to do that here. And if you are a Guy Pearce fan, you really got to see this film just to see him turn on the marmy charisma, really in a way that I'd never seen him do in any other role. And once again, that is Lockout from 2012. All right, many, many recommendations for you there. Hopefully we'll appreciate some of those in conjunction with your appreciation of Roadhouse. If you do revisit it, many people have been revisiting it. I look at the streaming charts just out of curiosity when I plan for these podcast episodes. And the original Roadhouse is very popular and easily streamable on Amazon Prime. So if you're watching the new one, you can also watch the old one. I think it's also on HBO. So very, very easy to watch the original Roadhouse. And if you haven't seen it before, I hope that my commentary makes it a little more fun for you to watch. And if you have seen it before, I hope you enjoy the revisit and check out some of those other recommendations I gave here in the podcast. Okay, with that all out of the way, let me get into my conversation review with spoilers of the new Roadhouse, the Jake Gyllenhaal film, directed by Doug Liman. And we're getting to that conversation right now. This new film from director Doug Liman, and I do want to have a little moment here to touch on Doug Liman's diverse and really fascinating career. From Swingers back in 1996, which kicked off Vince Vaughn and Jon Favreau's careers, And then to the kind of forgotten, but what a blast of a movie from 1999, yet another classic movie from 1999 called Go, with an incredible soundtrack, which launched so many careers. And a few years after that, really getting into maybe his genre of choice from this point on, The Bourne Identity, a seminal action movie from this particular period of time, especially with hand-to-hand combat. And he was one of the creators of The O.C., which is a cultural touch point for a whole generation of folks. Mr. and Mrs. Smith. I don't think that's a great movie, by the way, but does have great action sequences and really fun performances. Even films that were considered bombs at the time, it got terrible reviews. For example, Jumper, the YA adaptation. Honestly, I enjoy Jumper because the action sequences are so good and so clear, even in this sci-fi realm, being able to track the logic of these very complicated and convoluted time jumping or location spanning action sequences. It's actually a lot of fun. But then he really nailed that with one of the absolute best action movies of the past decade or so, or maybe ever, Edge of Tomorrow, the Tom Cruise film. And they keep saying there's going to be a sequel to that. Hopefully there will be. But then, interestingly, he was able to scale things down, work with Tom Cruise again with American Made. This is in 2017. I'm skipping some of his other work here. But recently, he's kind of been wandering around. He made a badly received pandemic, low budget, shot in one location film with Anne Hathaway called Lockdown. I've never seen this, but I definitely want to see this. He made a movie called Chaos Walking, which I'm just seeing here on the filmography. I have got to watch this film, by the way, with Tom Holland and Daisy Ridley, among others. The cast is stacked beyond that. Directed by Doug Liman, who rarely does bad action sequences, and written by Charlie Kaufman. So, or at least one of the writers. Really a fascinating ingredient. That film's gotten terrible reviews, so I never watched it, but man, I got to watch it now. So he continues to be busy, was a producer and director on the very successful film The Recruit, or I should say series, Netflix series, The Recruit. And all of this leads to Roadhouse. All roads lead to Roadhouse, for Doug Liman at least. And starring Jake Gyllenhaal. As the film begins, we see that we are in a grungy, this is not a very well-lit bar environment. This is a very gritty and grungy locale, very different stylistic choice here. And Post Malone, of all people, is kicking ass in the middle of a bare-knuckle boxing ring. He's undefeated. Not coincidentally, Post Malone is playing on the speakers in this very scene. Some of his new country music. He's kind of changed his style recently. When a shadowy figure enters the ring to do battle, and it turns out it's Jake Gyllenhaal playing Dalton. He is a disgraced MMA fighter. He has, we discover over the course of the film, beaten one of his friends to death in the ring. We don't quite know why. We never discover why. But he was triggered. He was pushed too far. And when he gets pushed too far, he starts the killing. Jessica Williams is also here playing Frankie, and she is watching what's happening. She needs a cooler or a bouncer or a head breaker of some kind, because her club out on the Florida Keys is being intimidated and taken over by the local mobster kingpin, who we never actually meet. We only hear him on the phone, but we do meet his son, and we'll get to that later. As soon as Post Malone discovers that this is Jake Gyllenhaal under his hoodie, he's like, oh no, I'm not fighting that guy. That guy kills people. Apparently, this is how Dalton makes his money. He collects the money when everybody forfeits when he walks into the ring. It seems like he probably makes decent money this way. I guess you can't find many of these fights, though, so I guess it is a limited, it's a windfall, but rare. And this is when Frankie shows up to approach him. She knows who he is. I need someone like you. He kind of turns down her offer. And he says, no, I'm a little busy right now. By the way, he's been stabbed. I forgot to mention that. He's been stabbed in the parking lot by somebody who's mad about losing money. He knows how to take care of that. Just a little tape will take care of it. And it doesn't really matter anyway, because he's actually planning to spend the rest of his night with his big winnings to park in front of a moving train. But he does change his mind on that and decides instead to head down to the Florida Keys. By the way, the tone of this early on, very dark. This could be a dark film, by the way. That could be an interesting take on all of this. But opening with a near suicide, maybe a little too dark for me, I think, considering where this film is actually headed to eventually. As soon as he shows up at this Florida Keys location, he meets an adorable girl who runs a bookstore that she inherited from her dead mom. This is all incredibly cheesy, by the way, but I think very intentional. And just like you have a Western, once again, let's do the Shane analogy. There's a little boy, in this case, a little girl, younger girl, who's looking up to this guy to come and rescue her. And he bonds to this younger character. But not only do we have the metaphor, like I mentioned in my commentary on the first Roadhouse, that this is basically a Western, we have to have someone in the film tell us, oh, this is just like a Western. You should read some Westerns. A little on the nose, but I think this is knowing. The film in some ways is maybe a little too knowing about what it's trying to do. And I'll save kind of some of that commentary towards the end. He shows up at this bar, quite a location for this bar. I got to tell you, this is a huge, this is an incredible bar, by the way. I definitely want to hang out at this bar. Didn't really want to go to the other Roadhouse. This one, I think I did want to hang out at this bar. And similar to the first Roadhouse, Dalton hangs out, gets a feel for the place, sees what's going on. He just kind of watches how everybody works. He's figuring things out. Being an MMA fighter seems way more realistic than being a philosophy professor as someone who can really take care of business. Oh, by the way, Gyllenhaal in incredible shape, and the film ogles his body. Like, there are so many scenes of just his body lit in a way like he's like a statue or something. So he looks incredible physically. And the film knows it. They like have multiple scenes where the purpose of the shot is just to stare at his torso, basically. But very convincing in being, I mean, this type of shape you will be in if you were an MMA fighter. And a little commentary here on Jessica Williams as Frankie. I've liked Jessica Williams when she was on The Daily Show. She might even still be on there. I don't really watch The Daily Show for quite some time now. I liked her on Shrinking. I thought she was a lot of fun. And later in the film here, in the midpoint of the film and beyond, I think she does a really good job of delivering some punchlines and some jokes, but man, they give her some really clunky exposition. And when she is just like monologuing the history of the island or her uncle or all the, it's rough. She's struggling a little bit with this, but I think anybody would. This is like a very clunky exposition-laden dialogue they're giving her. But I do appreciate she lands some very off-the-cuff jokes that might even be ad-libs, and I think they land very well. Good job with the comedy, but man, A, let's not have so much monologuing of exposition, and B, maybe not as adept at pulling that off. But then again, who is? And now this all leads up to my favorite scene in the entire film. Dalton takes the thugs that show up, this little motorcycle gang, and he basically takes them all apart. First, he checks in. Do you have insurance? Are you sure? You're okay? And he just starts by slapping them around. And when they don't back down right away, literally slapping them around, by the way, he beats them all. And this is very convincing. It's very kinetic. It's a lot of fun. Like, it is a very exciting, legitimately exciting fight sequence, and has the least of this technique we'll see over the course of the movie, where we literally take the camera, goes into fist cam, and is punching people. And I didn't really like that CGI technique. The less CGI they have here in general, the more I liked the fight sequences. And I do ding the film significantly for its use of CGI, not only here in the fights, but later on you see Dalton, someone tries to run him over, goes to a CGI where he hops up in the air. It's like, it goes into like MCU special effects territory and completely unnecessary. More beating up people in the parking lot and with just stunt coordination done as practically as possible, and less CGI. CGI is just takes you out of the experience, I think, my opinion. It's fine for Live, Lie, Die, Repeat. It's fine for Edge of Tomorrow, like I mentioned earlier. Not great for a film that's about punching people in the face or slapping them. Out of this gang of thugs, I have to call out Arturo Castro, by the way, who plays Mo, who's just like this like sweet puppy dog among these killers. And he just gives a great performance. He's like so utterly likable. He gets all the funniest lines. And yeah, I mean, I think he's going to be a star, this kid. The punchline of this whole thing, of course, is that he then has to take these people to the hospital afterwards. The people he just beat up, he's going to take them to the hospital. This is where he meets Ellie, played by Daniela Melchior, I think her name is. And I have liked her in other things, but I have to say she has absolutely no chemistry with Jake Gyllenhaal. Definitely a weakness here in the film. Not that, you know, going back to what I was saying in the previous commentary, this film is pretty sexless. I mean, I think they have sex when they go out on their first date or second date, when they go out to that sandbar, whatever you would call it. I'm pretty sure they hooked up there, but we don't see any of it. And pretty surprising with like the violence in this film and some of the over the top intentional goofiness that they don't at least have a playful sex scene. But I don't even know if I'd want to see that because these actors really don't have a lot of chemistry with each other, unfortunately. She gets to stitch up Dalton, and this is where he does get to recycle at least one line of Swayze's dialogue from the first film, that pain doesn't hurt. But then he immediately flinches, so maybe there's a little wink here at the first film. He's staying out on the boat, which is coincidentally, he just mentions, hey, you know, I was thinking about this is where I'm going to stay. I saw this place called The Boat. I'm going to hang out there. Maybe someone will rent it to me. And Jessica Williams' Frankie character is just like, oh, that's mine. Hey, you can stay there. Sure. Okay. Coincidentally, conveniently, whatever, but fine. I do find this very funny, similar to the first Roadhouse film. Once again, almost certainly a wink here that just like in that film, they're like, we need to find a place where we can murder this character, where it looks like an accident, where we will blow up the entire farm because to smoke him out. When not only do they know exactly where he is, it's a completely open and unsecured area. Similar here. I mean, someone actually does at one point pop up inside of the boat and try to shoot him. Okay, fine, finally. But even after that moment, he is the number one on everyone's kill list. And he goes back and sleeps that night while people are being kidnapped and all this other crazy logistics are happening to get him in a vulnerable position when they could just sink his boat while he's sleeping in it. Like this is not that complicated. This is approximately where Billy Magnuson shows up as the head honcho's inept son, kind of privileged and idiotic. And any movie that has Billy Magnuson in it is going to improve by having him in it. He's great in like every scene he's in. He knows exactly what the film he's in. He knows exactly how to play the part. Watch Game Night if you haven't. He plays a complete moron in that film, hilariously, perfectly. And then here he gets to play this entitled moron who basically wants to get a straight razor shave and wants the captain and the person who's shaving him to somehow keep the water from being bumpy while he's trying to get shaved. This is just such a perfect scene to explain the idiocy of this character. So we immediately hate him, and we immediately love that Magnuson is having so much fun playing him. And then what happens over the course of the middle of the film is they continuously try to get rid of Dalton. First, they try to intimidate him. Then they try to murder him. He is incredibly adept at taking care of business. Gyllenhaal, I think, is really charming here. I think your mileage may vary. I've heard people have the reaction they can't stand him here. Every one of these little smirks, every time he took care of himself, he really felt like he's almost auditioning for Spider-Man, which, you know, was rumored that he almost had that role back in the day. And it's that type of thing where he's making a quip each time he beats somebody up. So it really is like an R-rated Spider-Man riff here. And I like the way that the action is actually coordinated. I like the fact that someone pulls a gun on him and he goes, well, if your finger's broke, you can't pull the trigger. So then he just breaks the guy's finger and the guy's surprised. Oh, you broke my finger after he pulled the gun on him. All of this is very entertaining to me anyway. And I think he is very charming in this role. And I think that really matters whether you're going to buy in with this at all. If you don't buy in with him, if you think he's smug and annoying, if you don't like Gyllenhaal, don't watch this movie. It's like really built on the back of his charisma to large part why Swayze works in that first film. I didn't call it out during that commentary, but Swayze is very charming in that role, especially when he's doing his little philosophizing, which is so corny, but he pulls it off. And I think that is so important to that first film working. If Swayze was not charismatic, inept in that first film, I don't think it would be a cult classic today. People would just laugh at it as a disaster. And this film, which is much more proficiently made, obviously by Lyman, who's a much more proficient director on a much larger budget and with much more elaborate and exciting action sequences, nonetheless, you really need the charisma of Gyllenhaal to center the film. And if that doesn't work for you, you're not going to like this film. And then at about the midpoint of the film, this on the phone only Billy Magnuson's father, the head honcho here, the real power, the real muscle here in the town, who's in prison and calling to check in on the ineptitude he's hearing about how his son is handling this whole situation. So he decides to bring a loose cannon into the circumstance. Not sure. This is the Conor McGregor character, basically, who plays Knox, who has Knox tattooed on his abs 3 times, like just so you know his name, makes his entrance from by jumping out a window where he's been caught with a wife, I think, by the husband. So he's just walking through the middle of town, completely naked, looking for someone to of the right size to borrow their wardrobe, and also burns the whole town down in the meantime. Not sure why he did that. Just draw even more attention to yourself. And in the second half of the film, McGregor really becomes a bigger and bigger part as this progresses. And this is where I start to lose the film a little bit for me. I was really enjoying the film up until that midpoint. And also along with that, right around the midpoint is when we have that sexless sex scene with Gyllenhaal and his love interest. Once again, their chemistry is not very good, so that doesn't really work. And worse is McGregor's performance here, which I think is absolutely disastrous. I've heard this bandied about also on the internet chatter, but people have said if it was purely a physical performance, a wordless performance, would it have been better? I think that, yes, probably would have been better. I think if he was just physically menacing, he can fight, obviously. He's very striking looking, obviously. So maybe if it had been purely physical, it would have worked, but giving him so much dialogue and this weird delivery he has, and I mean, he's not a good actor is basically what it comes down to. He definitely has charisma, by the way. So maybe there's something there eventually, but they should have done something here to correct this performance a little bit for me. And once again, your mileage may vary. If you love the Gyllenhaal performance, and if you love this Conor McGregor performance, I think you're going to love this movie. For me, I liked half of this, didn't like the other half, more or less. The film also gets a little bogged down here towards the second half. I mean, like kind of the padded out to 2 hours, I'm sure. We have a little mystery injected here. What happened in the ring? Why did Gyllenhaal lose his cool? We never find out. What's actually the plan? Why are they trying to drive these people away from their homes, from their businesses, from this particular resort? Oh, we also get this whole side plot. It turns out the crooked cop who's working with the bad guys is actually Ellie's father. So that's the way that in the first film, we had this tie back where Ben Gazzara had actually dated or wanted to date, had the thing for the Kelly Lynch character. This is the way where you kind of twist her into the plot tangentially. I think it works a little bit better to have the dad there, but then we're just adding this important character pretty late in the game. So it's a little odd. And at this point, they've taken his girl. They've burned the bookstore. They've threatened all his friends. They've threatened his life. And Dalton has been pushed too far. Time to, well, he doesn't tear out throats. I got to tell you, you got to have this guy tear out throats. You did everything else. You were willing to do some of this craziness. He's got to tear out a throat. He doesn't tear out a throat. He does it the realistic way. He punches the guy in the throat, the first bad guy in the throat that he encounters, breaks some bone in his throat, and that's it. You can't breathe anymore. You're going to die. And he is like full-on psychopath here, once again, correlating to the sequence in the original film with the throat tearing out. That is the sign that he has gone off the deep end to the dark side. He does let Mo survive. Mo just gives him all the details that he knows about regarding the abduction and the plot overall and the location of all the main players. And then he's allowed to leave. And good thing, because like I said, Arturo Castro is so likable in this character, in this role. It's really a balancing act to even have a character like this, like a cuddly, likable villain character. But it works, and he's very funny in like every scene he's in. He just wanted to join a gang. He just wanted to ride a bike, and it was this is the only way he could find people who rode bikes with him. He didn't want to get into all this criminal activity. You actually believe that. And like I mentioned, Dalton not only has, he must have a very dark background, because not only has he killed this guy, he's preserved the body so he could frame a cop. Like, he's going serial killer mode here. This would have been interesting, right? To stay with this tone, to really let him get really dark, really conniving. That would have been interesting. Something that, once again, I think would have been interesting in the first film as well. But they have to go back into slapstick territory, and they do the same thing here. They decide to shift tones back into the silly. And it begins almost right away. He says, I'm going to frame this cop. I'm going to knock you unconscious, give you a concussion. You're going to have no short-term memory. The second that this guy comes to, he remembers everything that happened, which is definitely a joke and an entertaining one at that. And of course, the film embracing its goofiness. I like the fact that Ellie's father shows up going like, oh, she's been abducted. Come rescue her. And then it's like, I tricked you to come here. She hasn't been abducted. Oh, wait a second. She has been abducted. It's all just goofy silliness at this point. And this last 20-30 minutes of the film is very entertaining, I think. Dalton has taken off with Ellie's ex-boyfriend's boat, filled it with explosives. He also has a sack full of money, and his plan is to blow up the boat adjacent to the yacht where he's come to meet with all the baddies. He's not really thought about Ellie's rescue plan. There is a very cool sequence where she's trying to smash the window. He encounters her. The water floods in. This is all very cool. It's CGI, but it's well done. I thought it was very cool the way they did this. Obviously spent some money here on this sequence here at the end of the film. Honestly, the film may have worked better if they had kind of kept it more low-key, made it feel less like a giant action spectacle and maybe a little something more grounded. But nonetheless, these action sequences here at the end are a lot of fun. And starting with that smashing of the window here at the bottom of the boat. And then we have these boat races. We have the McGregor character, indestructible, of course, as you would expect. All this culminates with mashing the boat into the roadhouse. And then we have a protracted fight sequence between Dalton and Knox. Knox kills Billy Magnussen's character, just to speak to the fact that he's just a wild card at this point. He's not really strategic, so not a great plan from Dad to send this guy to fix things, quote unquote. And Jake finally does him in by stabbing him many, many times, even after it looked like he was defeated. And then he rides off into the sunset and leaves a giant sack of cash to that sweet little girl with that bookstore. And during the credits, we find out that Knox is not dead and wanders off. All right, so the things I really liked about this, Gyllenhaal's charisma, I think, really works here. Very important to these type of films, like I touched on in my discussion of those recommendations earlier. McGregor did not work for me, but if that had worked, I think I would have been more enthusiastic about this film. The fight sequences, I don't know why there's CGI in those. I understand Lyman was going for something. He was experimenting. I hear he shot things with four different camera setups simultaneously, and then he merged them together. It's just distracting. Like I mentioned before, the parking lot brawl where he just beats everybody up, and it feels like you are just over the shoulder, right alongside Gyllenhaal as he's just breaking heads and breaking arms, is a lot of fun. And like, honestly, like my pulse quickened there in a way that probably none of the other action sequences did. And it's just a total blast. And more of that, I think, would have been better for the film, for it to work for me. The shift in tone from comedic back and forth. I know it's an homage to the original film, but I don't think they pulled it off here, even though it's intentional and they're winking at the original film. Still seems like not really necessary, to be honest, and not that effective. Distracting, once again, meaninglessly. They needed a better romance. If you're going to include a romance, at least make it work, I think, on the screen. Although a chaste romance is, once again, kind of in line with these kind of Westerns, but hey, you can update some of this stuff. And the performances are uneven, although, once again, considering the source material, maybe that's intentional as well. Billy Magnussen's great as the villain, a buffoon of a villain, but still very entertaining. But my biggest question for this, and it circles back even to the Ghostbuster films, wouldn't this be better if this was a film that reminded you of Roadhouse or in the vein of Roadhouse, rather than saying this is Roadhouse? It seems like we can't make anything anymore unless it's based on something else. And then people complain because they expected the other thing or they expected a specific thing because of the setting of expectations, which just comes from the branding, right? Like if the Ghostbusters was not the Ghostbusters, it was just another ghost comedy. And then, oh, maybe the Ghostbusters show up at some point. So it becomes like a sideways sequel or in the universe of or something like that. You can't really do that with Roadhouse because, I mean, there's no like extended universe for the Roadhouse. I hope they never do anything like that. But then why even call this thing Roadhouse? Unfortunately, I know why this thing is called Roadhouse. It's because it's the number one film streaming right now. People are watching it because it's called Roadhouse. So in the end, that's the decision that's being made. So maybe it is maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it is the right thing to do because people will watch it now. People will complain. It's not like the original, but people will watch it. And then 10 years from now, they'll be like, wow, you know, that film had some good action sequences. I enjoyed that film. It'll be a way to get people to watch things, even if they complain at first. Maybe this makes sense in some way. But I think it would be more well-received if it was just considered a film like Roadhouse, neo-Westerns, about a shadowy figure that comes into town and rescues the town from the bad guy. That's been a formula forever. This is a genre of itself, doesn't necessarily need to be a straight remake, but like I said, this is probably what will make people watch it. All right, so that is the Roadhouse rundown. Oh, the rundown, by the way, with The Rock. There's a really fun action comedy. Check that one out too. So throw that onto the list of recommendations. All right, until next time, have a happy Easter weekend, and I'll talk to you soon.